Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today from the Middle East, North and West Africa, a region in turmoil. Who benefits and who pays the price? What's going on? What are the impacts on us all, as well as on politics within the United States? Yemen is fundamentally in a civil war, as an uprising has led to the deposing of the U.S.-backed leader. Saudi Arabia has said it would defend the deposed government against what it says are Iran-backed rebels, and the United States has removed its personnel, including military personnel connected to its Yemeni bombing campaign, using drones. The U.S. has also closed its embassy. Our guest is Baha Shiban, Yemen coordinator for a UK human rights organization that focuses on the region. And the expansion of ISIS and other factional fighting is being felt in Iraq, Libya, Syria, and now northern Nigeria. What is behind the power struggles in the region? How central is the defense of Israel, oil, and other U.S. interests in the turmoil? We have a roundtable discussion with veteran foreign correspondent and author Reese Ehrlich and professor of politics and international studies Stephen Zunis, as well as Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. President Barack Obama and Afghan President Ashraf Ghani will appear together at the White House today after a series of meetings between Ghani and the Obama administration. Afghanistan's leader is expected to ask Obama to keep U.S. troops in his country for a longer period, and the Obama administration is expected to agree. Yesterday, Ghani praised the U.S. military's commitment to Afghanistan.
2,215 Americans who paid the ultimate sacrifice. To more than 20,000 American soldiers who've been wounded in action, close to a million American servicemen and women have gotten to know my country.
Officials predict many of the 9,800 American troops there now will remain into next year. The original plan was to cut the number of troops to 5,500 by the end of this year. Mass gunmen attacked a bus about an hour's drive from the Afghan capital Kabul today, killing 13 people, according to local officials. This is the third time unknown gunmen have targeted bus passengers over the past month. The Taliban insurgent group has denied any connection to the attacks, which some have blamed on militants who have sworn allegiance to the Islamic State. However, no group has claimed responsibility for the bus attacks. Iraq is expected to request the U.S.-led coalition provide airstrikes in the campaign to retake Tikrit from Islamic State insurgents. If the coalition accepts the request, it would be the largest collaboration against Islamic State by Iraqi forces, the Iranian-backed paramilitaries, and the United States and its allies. Meanwhile, Canada says it will extend its mission against Islamic State to March 30, 2016. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas officially announced his intention to run for the presidency of the United States yesterday at Virginia's private Christian Liberty University, making him the first candidate from either party to do so. Pacifica's Scott Baba reports.
I am announcing that I'm running for president of the United States.
Republican Senator Ted Cruz has fought vehemently against birth control and abortions and has come out strongly against net neutrality and gay marriage, although he argued that the latter should be a state's right issue. His speech at Liberty University addressed many of his concerns. Among the wide-ranging list of topics that he spoke on were the stripping down of national education standards, decreasing taxes, and fighting the Affordable Care Act.
Imagine in 2017, a new president signing legislation repealing every word of Obamacare.
Cruz also took a swipe at President Obama's recent actions on immigration, despite the fact that Cruz himself is the son of a Cuban immigrant.
Instead of the lawlessness and the president's unconstitutional executive amnesty, Imagine a president that finally secures the borders.
While Cruz's announcements has stirred the political water, many consider his chances of winning the national election slim. Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine, said that his ideology was most likely too extreme to succeed.
Here's a guy who calls Social Security a Ponzi scheme and, is really incredibly not just anti-abortion, but anti-birth control.
Cruz's early announcement puts him as the first entrant on what is expected to be a crowded field. Scott Baba, Pacific Radio, KPFA.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say the number of uninsured people in the U.S. is at its lowest level in 15 years. The CDC says the number of uninsured U.S. residents fell by more than 11 million since President Barack Obama signed the Affordable Care Act 5 years ago. An estimated 37 million people remain uninsured. A German airliner carrying 148 people has crashed in a remote part of the French Alps, and President François Hollande says there doesn't appear to be any survivors. He spoke at a press conference this morning. His comments were translated by Al Jazeera in English.
C'est une tragédie, une nouvelle tragédie aérienne.
It's a tragedy, a new aerial tragedy. We will make sure we know all the causes of what happened, and we will share that information with all the concerned authorities, German and Spanish, and contact all the families as well. We're in mourning because it's a tragedy that happened on our soil.
The German wing's Airbus A320 crashed as it traveled from Barcelona, Spain to Dusseldorf, and officials say search and rescue teams are headed to the site. The use of firing squads to carry out executions is now legal in the state of Utah. Governor Gary Herbert signed a law yesterday that authorizes the use of firing squads if lethal drugs are not available to execute the state's capital punishment laws. The Republican governor has said the state needs a backup execution method in case a shortage of lethal intravenous drugs persists. Manufacturers opposed to capital punishment have been making such drugs off-limits to prisons. The House has overwhelmingly approved a resolution urging President Barack Obama to send lethal weapons to Ukraine to protect its sovereignty in its fight against Russian-backed rebels. Russian President Vladimir Putin denies arming rebels in the war in eastern Ukraine, which began in April after Moscow annexed the mostly Russian-speaking Crimean Peninsula. And the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday on whether the Americans with Disabilities Act requires police to take special precautions when trying to arrest armed and potentially violent suspects who have a mental illness. The case before the justices involved San Francisco police and how they dealt with a woman with schizophrenia who had threatened to kill her social worker. Police forced their way into Teresa Sheehan's room at a group home and then shot her 5 times after she came at them with a knife. Sheehan survived and later sued the city, claiming police had a duty under the ADA to consider her mental illness and take more steps to avoid a violent confrontation. I'm Christina Onnestad. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Civil war in Yemen, or though it seems, Houthi rebels opposed to the U.S.-backed government of Mansour Hadi forced the Hadi government to flee earlier this year when they took over the presidential palace in Yemen's capital city. Hadi had allowed U.S. drone strikes in Yemen against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and ISIS. He was replaced by Ali Abdullah Saleh. Saleh was forced to step down as part of the Arab Spring uprising, and now he's back. Houthi-led rebels, representing a loose coalition of fighters and supporters, continued their push south over the weekend, taking Yemen's third largest city, Taiz, on Sunday. On Tuesday, it was reported that the rebel groups have pushed all the way to the town of Kirsch, just 60 miles from Yemen's second largest city, Aden. Aden is the present base of operations for deposed President Mansour Hadi. Meanwhile, the United States and Britain announced that they were evacuating their special forces from Yemen, although the White House has promised that drone attacks on al-Qaeda affiliates will continue from neighboring Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has promised to oppose the Houthi-led uprising. Fighting in Yemen is also increasingly being seen as yet another proxy battle between Sunni Arab states, such as Saudi Arabia, and Shiite-dominated Iran, which has provided training, it is said, to the Shiite Houthis. The United Nations Special Envoy to Yemen warned the Security Council on Sunday that the situation in the country is at the edge of civil war. The assessment came just days after a devastating bombing at two mosques in the Yemeni capital that killed more than 140 people and injured at least 200 more. ISIS has since claimed responsibility for the attack. Let's hear a short clip now from Euronews on the situation in Yemen.
Yemen's embattled government has called for military assistance from Gulf Arab states to stop the advance of Shia Houthi fighters into the south of the country. The request for intervention comes as the Houthis move closer to the southern city of Aden. Yemen's foreign minister says of the plea for regional aid, "We've requested this for the sake of speed, because the factor of time is not in anyone's favor, especially not in the favor of those behind constitutional legitimacy. It's not in our interests, as Yemeni citizens don't want to see more bloodshed." The Houthis took control of Yemen's capital, Sana'a, in September. They seized Taiz, the country's third largest city, at the weekend. The Houthis and Yemeni President Hadi have established rival power centers in Sana'a and Aden and denied each other's legitimacy. The advance of the Houthis, who share a Shiite Muslim ideology with Iran, has alarmed the Gulf states. Saudi Arabia's foreign minister said on Monday that his country would take necessary measures to protect the region from aggression.
Okay, I'd like to introduce and welcome our guest, Bahra Shiban, who is a member of the Yemeni National Dialogue Conference and is the Yemen coordinator for the UK human rights watchdog organization Reprieve. Bahra Shiban, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, to get your assessment on what is going on, first, a lot of our listeners remember all of the hope of the Arab Spring, remembered what happened in Yemen and the deposing of the president at the time, who now is back. What really happened with that? What do you think allowed that shift? We know that his government was the Hadi government that has now been deposed is backed by the U.S. and clearly was allowing the drone attacks within Yemen. Do you think that had an impact on the uprising against him, or what do you think is involved?
Well, I think the main reason why the situation quickly deteriorated in the country is that the main spoilers of any transition were kept in the country, including the former president Ali Abdullah Saleh, and he was granted immunity from any prosecution, which allowed him to stay in the country, maintain his influence within the army. He has a lot of wealth, a lot of power, and eventually, just 2 days ago, he used the Air Force to try to hit the current president Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi. I think it's the only country in the world where you have a former president trying to kill the current president. In reference to the drone strikes that you were mentioning, I think the drone strikes will not stop, even if Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi was changed, even if he was replaced by another successor, even if you have a new elections. That's simply because the strategy of the United States since 2011 has changed, and I'm talking specifically about the counterterrorism strategy, focusing primarily on drones to attack what they call imminent threats to the United States. Now the issue is that will this create stability in the current in the country or not? The United States doesn't seem to care about the implications of that strategy on the Yemeni government, and Hadi had to pay a very high price for following U.S. strategy.
Yeah, and so what about, I mean, who are then the supporters of the Houthi-led rebels? It seems to be a kind of a coalition of sorts with tribal groups and various other people who were opposed to the Hadi government. What can you tell us about who they are?
Well, the Houthis mainly depended on the former president alliances in the regions they're in control of. Actually, when they took control of Sana'a, the capital, that was with direct cooperation between the Houthis and the forces that used to be under the supervision of Saleh's son before 2011. So this is in terms of military relation. And then they extended, of course, this cooperation in terms of tribal affiliation. And those are mainly the people who felt that they were affected and lost their influence after the uprising in 2011. So what I would say is that they found an area or space where they can all operate, and they can find that a common goal that the current regime or the current system is not working in the favor of the Houthis or the former president's allies.
Right. So again, I mean, looking at what happened in the Arab Spring, I mean, we clearly saw what happened in Egypt, the what I would call a counter-revolution that has happened since, you know, the spread of the Arab Spring and the hope of that, including the protesters in Yemen. And Salah, he was forced out. But the reverse of that, his return, from what you're saying, the fact that he was kept in the country, granted immunity, et cetera, it seemed as though that was already put in place in a way, or the beginnings of it, or the basis of it put in place, even as there was a change in government. You know, that's confusing to a lot of people because, you know, generally people try to figure out, well, who are the good guys, who are the bad guys? You know what I mean? Barash.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'll try to simplify things, is that the former president remained in power for 33 years, and he used that with the assistance of many allies in the country. And I think at the time when he was stepping down, he knew that he can keep his allies if he stayed inside the country, keeping his using his influence and wealth to keep operating within the country. And the President Hadi, from his side, wasn't able to deliver to the people many of the things that they were hoping after 2011. And that's why the Houthis, especially the Houthi leader, have always said about him that he is a puppet of the United States and the foreign powers inside the country. And in the past 3 years, at the same time, President Hadi always used to praise the drone war inside the country. Even when a number of drone strikes have clearly killed civilians, he would also hesitate to step up and clearly announce even a little bit of responsibility towards the victims. So I think this whole international backed up president was working in a way in the favor of the Houthis. At the same time, you have President Saleh, who still have his allies inside the country, trying also to operate against President Hadi.
Right. And the on March 17th, it was reported the U.S. couldn't account for $500 million in weapons shipments to Yemen. And one wonders where those weapons have ended up. And the New York Times is also reporting that the CIA will maintain some covert agents, you know, within Yemen. It certainly seems as though the U.S. had been playing both sides, so to speak, and that Hadi was discredited because, as you say, people see him as a puppet and basically just doing the bidding of the United States. And surely a lot of people who participated in the Arab Spring uprising in Yemen, they did not literally put their lives on the line, I imagine, many of them, for that. Barah Shiban.
Well, the United States work within the country through the National Security Bureau. This is an intelligence bureau that was created and funded by the United States. And interestingly enough, that the National Security is still operating even after the Houthis took control of Sana'a. The National Security was under the supervision of Saleh's nephew, and he still maintained a huge influence within within the bureau. The other thing is that the United States funded what was called the Special Forces, and under the Special Forces, there was a special unit called the Counterterrorism Unit. And now we know that the Special Forces have fallen to the hands of the Houthis. So, for your American audience, if they're wondering, yes, your money have eventually went to the hands of the Houthis. I mean, I think the normal Yemeni people don't actually make their decisions based on counterterrorism policies or foreign relations. Or how has the relation between Yemen and the United States, and will it benefit Yemen? They make their decision based on, will we have a government that will be able to deliver services? And yeah. I think that was we were missing in the past 3 years, and the international community, with all the support for the political process, failed to build the capacity of a government that can maintain and deliver services to the ordinary people.
Yeah, I'm sure you're quite right there. Just finally, though, on this, you know, talk about a proxy war. I mean, Yemen is reported to be a majority Sunni country. And the Houthis are part of the minority Shiite community. The Shiite, of course, connected or seen with Iran, and the Sunnis with Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has expressed outrage at what is going on and getting involved on many different levels. So you have a majority-minority type situation, and you talk about services as well. Could it mean that the people who were, quote-unquote, the minorities perhaps felt discriminated against in that way, as often happens when there's a minority-majority situation? Or is it a bit – I'm sure it's more complicated than that, but is it part of what likely is going on?
The situation in Yemen is quite different from if you would put it the Iraqi model, where you'd have Sunnis and Shiites.
Okay.
And Sunnis wouldn't go and pray at the mosques of the Shiites, and vice versa. In Yemen, actually, people like there are no actual deep divisions within the society in terms of their affiliation to the Islamic school. People actually even go pray at the same mosques. People just choose which mosque to pray based on what is the mosque that is closest to me. So the issue is purely political, and specifically, I would point out for the people who lost their influence after 2011, and that Saleh and his allies felt that there was some space or some room to operate if they kept hitting on the Houthi insurgency, because the Houthis were fought back in his days in the Saleh days, the Houthis have entered six wars with the state. this, like creating this this space where you have people who feel that they've lost their influence and feel that there is a potential possibility that they can come back can come back to power, created I would say like a joint interest to come and start attacking attacking Hadi. And interestingly enough, when the Houthis started moving towards Sana'a, they wouldn't even mention Hadi. They always mentioned Islah Party, who maintained who gained a lot of strength after 2011. Only after they took control of the capital, they started attacking Hadi.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, this certainly is a situation we are going to continue to watch. We're out of time right now, but Barashiban, member of the Yemeni National Dialogue Conference and Yemen coordinator of the UK human rights organization, Reprieve, thank you for joining us. We hope to have you back.
Thank you.
We are going to take a station break now, and when we return, we're going to continue discussing the region. Our guests, Reese Ehrlich, Stephen Zunis, Dr. Gerald Horn, for a roundtable discussion. We'll be right back. Now your fault be that.
Suffer for world. Now your fault be that. Me I say, now your fault be that. You all to please take your minds out of this musical contraption.
And that shuffering and smiling, the great late Fela Kuti. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Go to www.sotrueradio.org and our Facebook page. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. If you are a member of Facebook, please like and friend us. We cover a lot on Facebook that we don't get to. And also on our website, while we are on the air, we'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. And we would like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners anywhere in the Middle East. And of course, you could catch this show anytime, 24/7, and you could also get our back shows. Now, today, for our subversive, from our subversive historian, Gabrielle San Roman, the calendar of revolt, March 24th, there was a brutal right wing military dictatorship that took over in Argentina back in 1976. Jorge Rafael Videla. He was a dictator from 1976 to 1981, and he is remembered largely for his role in the what is known as the Dirty War that killed thousands of political dissidents. And that's the subversive historian calendar of revolt for today. We are now going to return to our show, and I'd like to welcome our panelists. Let's see, where should we begin? Let's start with welcoming Reese Ehrlich, veteran foreign correspondent and author of the new book, Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. It has a foreword with Noam Chomsky, by Noam Chomsky. In 2006, Reese Ehrlich shared a Peabody Award as segment producer for Crossing East, a radio documentary on the history of Asians in the United States. And in 2012, the Society of Professional Journalists awarded Reese Ehrlich a prize for the best radio explanatory journalism for his documentary Inside the Syrian Revolution. Reese Ehrlich, welcome.
Good morning.
Also on the line, we'd like to welcome back Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy in Focus Project in the Institute for Policy Studies, an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor of Tikkun, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Dr. Zunis, welcome.
Great to be with you again.
Also on the line with us, Dr. Gerald Horn, who holds the Moores Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. Dr. Horn has published over 30 books, including his newest, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, one of our regulars there on our weekly round table. So, what I actually want to do, though it might seem unrelated, but I think we all know that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is very much connected to a lot of the turmoil in the countries that we are going to be discussing. So why don't we go to a clip on that right now, because there was a recent election that happened in Israel. Netanyahu made a lot of negative news by making some comments that were considered racist about Arabs voting, and he later apologized. He had also said that he would not accept a two-state solution, and then he backtracked after that, claiming that's really not what he meant. Let's hear that discussion right now, some Palestinian commentary and all on this.
Bibi Netanyahu will stand and say, Wolf, I will do it. I will make it. But then the deeds are translated into settlements, dictations, and anything that would undermine the two-state solution. Now Mr. Netanyahu needs to put his money where his mouth is now. If he really is serious about the two-state solution, he needs to stop settlement activities. He needs to say to his people that we must recognize the state of Palestine on the 1967 lines to live side by side the state of Palestine. He has done nothing but to undermine the two-state solution. He has increased settlement activities since 2009 till now by 40%. Wolf, you know that we have a national and consensus government, yes, formed with agreement with Hamas, but the political program of the government is two states on 1967, the state of Palestine, to live side by side the state of Israel and peace and security. So, and there is not a single member of Hamas or Fatah in that government. I know that once a Palestinian state is established, we must have one authority, one gun, and the rule of law. But Wolf, the other thing Mr. Netanyahu is doing now, he's withholding our money. You know, we're not a state. Israel collects our taxes and revenues for us, $130 million a month. This is the fourth month. They don't transfer our money. They're pirating our money. Our hospitals are about to collapse. We're not paying salaries. And then, if Mr. Netanyahu is seeking the end of the Palestinian Authority, we may soon call upon him to assume his responsibility as the occupying power.
Yeah, so just starting with you, Stephen Zunis, I mean, we do want to get some discussion clearly on the areas in which you all are expert. And I said in my intro, from the Middle East to North and West Africa, a region in turmoil, who benefits and who pays the price, and the impacts on all of us, as well as on politics within the United States. But just Stephen Zunis, there are several, quote unquote, elephants in the room when one looks at the region. One of them being the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. A lot of people think that's central. Others say, well, what's happening with Iran is central. That's also connected clearly with the security of Israel. There's always oil. And the United States having a kind of a seemingly confused policy, which may not be too confused at all. So before we discuss some of the other specific areas, Stephen Zunis, what is your take? What do you think is central to all of this turmoil going on? And what role does the security of Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict on the one hand, and then the Israel-Iran spectre of a conflict there, have to do with a lot of the turmoil that's happening?
Well, I think it comes down to, as we've seen in conflict zones for all time, really, is that people desire justice. People desire self-determination. That can be national self-determination. In the cases where people are denied that, like in the case of Palestine, but also self-determination in terms of the majority of countries in that part of the world that are ruled by an unelected elite, often propped up by foreign powers such as the United States. Israel and Palestine has become particularly central in part because, though, you know, many Jews see Zionism as a national liberation movement of an oppressed people, for those in the Middle East, they see it as a colonial settler state. So in many ways, Israel is a manifestation of the broader struggle they have had for so many centuries against Western imperialism, you know, going back to the time of the Crusades. And certainly there have been demagogues, including some reactionary Islamist extremists, that have taken advantage of injustices, you know, such as the Israeli occupation, such as oppressive regimes like that of Assad in Syria, to advance their agenda, which of course creates all sorts of new problems and cleavages. But I really think we did have some hope in 2011 that civil society would finally take a leading role. We saw the power of strategic nonviolent action and bringing down a series of dictators. Unfortunately, both through the machinations of local elites and foreign powers, with the exception of Tunisia, we have not seen much in the way of a democratic transformation. And so the struggle continues between these very uncomfortable choices between Western imperialism, Islamist reaction, and various other autocratic and democratic elements.
Right, and Reese Ehrlich, I mean, your take basically on the same question. We know that in your work focuses quite a lot on Syria, and we would like to get into that a bit more. But just generally on this whole issue of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict on the one hand, and related to that, the conflict really with Israel and Iran, and especially now with the negotiations going on, and it gets really complicated because you see in Iraq, for example, the U.S. is now being called upon to join the Iranian forces in defense of Tikrit, which was Saddam Hussein's hometown. So things get really complicated here. Your take.
That.
Yeah, to say the least.
That's why we've got a few minutes to discuss it, right?
Right.
Well, my view is that while the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not the source of all the problems in the Middle East, the problems in the Middle East can't be resolved unless that issue is resolved.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, for Arab peoples, for virtually everyone in the region, the Israeli aggression is a source of anger, and there will be continued instability in the region so long as there's not an independent, viable Palestinian state next to a Israeli state. And I think that is possible to happen, but certainly the current government in Israel is not interested in that. Just as an example, we hear a lot about Syria and the conflict there, but what's forgotten is that Israel seized and annexed the Golan Heights of Syria, an issue that's virtually forgotten. But the Syrians haven't forgotten it, and it's a key element in why the U.S. has not been able to gather more support among rebels and opposition groups. U.S. policy is hated in the region. The people of Syria are not stupid. They see what happened when the U.S. claimed to bring democracy to Iraq and Afghanistan, when it continually backs Israel on almost every issue. That's the core of why the U.S. has failed to establish a pro-U.S. rebel group, civilian or military. So all of these issues are interconnected, and the U.S. manages to be on the wrong side on all of them.
Yeah, and Dr. Gerald Horn, your take on this? I mean, fundamentally the same question.
Well, I do not disagree with what the previous panelists have said, but I'd like to add a new issue, which is part of the problem in 2015 is the relative decline of U.S. imperialism. You see that with regard to Western European nations signing up with a Chinese-led competitor to the World Bank. With regard to Israel, even though the Thrust reports accurately that the conflict with Israel and the United States has to do with Israel backing off of the two-state solution and its racist comments about Arab voters in Israel, but it also has to do, once again, with the relative decline of U.S. imperialism. Of course, the United States is very upset with Israel because there have been credible accusations that Israel has been leaking U.S. military technology to China, which, of course, suggests that Israel is trying to hedge against the possibility that China will emerge as the leading power in the world. Interestingly enough, China supposedly then leaked that technology to Iran, which is in some way suggests that Israel is helping Iran, ironically enough. But you also see that in the rise of many different players with many different agendas in the region. You have Turkey with this neo-Ottoman empire dreams that has been interfering quite grievously in the internal affairs of Syria. You see it even with regard to Saudi Arabia. We know that the price of oil has fallen to pump. L.A. drivers know that more than most, and that has a lot to do not only with Saudi trying to hurt Russia, Iran, and Venezuela, but also U.S. production in terms of shale oil production in Texas. And so because you have so many different players in the game right now in that part of the world, it leads to more confusion, it leads to more cross wires, it leads to more chaos.
Yeah, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are having a roundtable discussion about the turmoil going on in the Middle East to North and West Africa region in turmoil. Who benefits? Who pays the price? What are the impacts on all of us? And our guests are Stephen Zunis, Reese Ehrlich, and Gerald Horn, Dr. Gerald Horn. So, Stephen Zunis, back to you for a moment. You hopefully heard the discussion that we had earlier with Barah Shiban, Yemen coordinator for a UK human rights organization and also other Yemeni-related entities. And I wondered if you care to comment on what now we see going on, really a civil war happening in Yemen. Clearly, I mean, a similar thing happening in Syria, Libya, basically a failed state just about at this point. And in Iraq, the New York Times has a headline that Iraq opts for consolidation over advance in the battle against ISIS. And ISIS and the Sunnis in the mainstream media, at least in relation to Iraq, are now being used interchangeably. So, Stephen Zunis, your comment on any interconnection with what's happening in those countries and the role that the U.S. has played in them.
I think one common theme is that when you have civil society marginalized, when outside forces such as the United States decide to deal with various favorite elites and factions, and ordinary people do not feel like they have a stake in the system, you create a power vacuum where the men with guns end up taking the lead. I mean, in Yemen, which has more weapons per capita, you know, than any country in the world, except for the United States. But even there, you had, and this is a country with a history of tribalism and conflict and civil war, and I mean, a mess going back for decades. And yet, you know, millions of people were able to put down their weapons and march nonviolently for an end of the U.S.-backed Saleh dictatorship. And what happens? The Saudis, with U.S. support, broker this deal where the pro-democracy forces are totally marginalized, put it in the hands of the Saleh's vice president, and again, you see the rise of the Houthis, who do not represent a majority, but given how everybody else is so marginalized and divide among themselves, they end up being the most powerful single force. And similarly, you know, we have seen how the propping up these dictatorial regimes and the military interventions have created such a devastation in these societies that it becomes very difficult for ordinary people to mobilize. And I think the only way we can really, at least in the longer term, have any hope for the region is that if the outside powers, and I think the United States is the most guilty of these, though there's certainly other contributors as well, allows the people to take the lead themselves and to stop sending arms, stop intervening, and rely on what we've seen from Eastern Europe to Latin America to Southeast Asia, and allow people power, ordinary people of that region, to be able to assert their own demands for justice and democracy.
Yeah, and Reese Ehrlich, I mean, given, you know, just looking at Syria there, and you see the quote-unquote rebels against the Assad government, al-Qaeda in there, ISIS being in there, then using Syria as a base, we are told anyway, you know, going into Iraq. The ISIS also having some increasing presence in the region, and we'll hear from Dr. Horn in a moment about its Boko Haram declaring allegiance to it. So again, as you say, likely we don't have enough time, but this really shows that the alliances in terms of the United States are not that stable, are there? Because on the one hand, they're negotiating with Iran, and on the other hand, when it comes to Syria, Iran had been supporting the Assad regime in Syria that the U.S. opposed and started throwing who knows what into Syria that has likely ended up in the hands of ISIS and al-Qaeda and who knows who else. And that has led to further destabilization, not only in Syria, but in the region.
Yeah, I think this is a reflection of the decline of U.S. imperialism, as Professor Horn noted. Remember, it was just over a year ago that the U.S. was prepared to bomb Assad for his alleged use of chemical weapons. And that was part of a plan to basically eliminate Assad and bring in a pro-U.S. regime. Now we are some year and some months later fighting on Assad's same side. The U.S. is bombing the Islamic State and, to a lesser extent, al-Qaeda-affiliated groups, and made a tacit alliance with Assad and making a tacit alliance with Iran. And it's a sign that the initial policy failed, not because of vacillation by Obama or indecision or lack of thinking through whatever all the other reasons that are tossed out there, but because they tried the policy and it failed. They couldn't find any so-called moderate rebels that had any significant base inside Syria. So now they're flailing around and they're trying another one. And this policy is going to explode as well, because you can't ally with the Assad regime. He's not interested in it. And at some point, the U.S. is going to figure out they made a big mistake and they shift in strategy. Ultimately, the people of Syria have to decide the future for themselves. That means without any of the outside powers intervening militarily and politically. But right now, if anything, all the outside powers from the U.S. to Iran to Russia have all doubled down and are not interested in doing that for the moment.
Yeah, and, you know, Dr. Horn, I mean, picking up on what Reese Ehrlich just said, I mean, it certainly is a quagmire that's going on. And I'd like you to bring in the specter of Libya in all of this, because Libya is a total mess. And the weapons, I mean, earlier we talked about all of the weapons that the U.S. quote-unquote lost track of in Yemen. Well, we've heard that story before. I think they lost track of weapons in a number of other places, and who knows where it's ended up. But with the U.S. involvement in Libya has certainly had a repercussion throughout the whole region. And so connect this, follow that Libya thread in terms of what's happening in Syria and the impact in other places as well, Dr. Horn.
Well, certainly the passage of United Nations Security Council Resolution 1973 in March 2011 was the beginning of many of the problems we now see. That is to say, that supposedly authorized a no-fly zone but actually led to regime change in Libya. This angered Russia in particular, which thought it had been traduced by the U.S. diplomats in New York at the United Nations. It also helped to cast shadows on what was going on in Libya because, of course, Al Arabiya, the Saudi station, had suggested that a genocide was about to unfold in Benghazi. It turns out that that was overblown. But at the same time, that playbook of playing up the idea of genocide and then calling for an external intervention helped to inspire the rebels in Syria, leading to the quagmire you see there. Likewise, the destabilization of Libya led to knock-on effects in neighboring Mali in Niger. That is to say, Mali was destabilized, leading to a French intervention. And then that bleeds into Nigeria, northern Nigeria, and the rise of Boko Haram. Now, you have elections taking place in what is now Africa's largest economy within days. And the president of Nigeria tells us that he will be mopping up Boko Haram within 4 or 5 weeks, which I think is an exaggeration at best. But it is fair to say that, once again, the fall of the price of oil has had a devastating impact on Nigeria's economy, helping to fuel Boko Haram. That is to say, last year the price of a barrel of oil was over $100. Right now it's between $40 and $50. Analysts are suggesting that next year it might be between $10 and $20. This is not only devastating Nigeria, I might also say it's devastating the economy of Texas, which is a major oil producer as well.
Right. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we have a roundtable going on with Stephen Zunis, Reese Ehrlich, and Dr. Gerald Horn about the turmoil in the Middle East from to North Africa and West Africa, who benefits, who pays the price, and the impact on us as well as politics in the United States. So going back to you, Stephen Zunis, Dr. Horn talked about Boko Haram, which on March 7th pledged allegiance to the Islamic State, or ISIL, or IS, has various names. Boko Haram has killed thousands, kidnapped hundreds during a six-year campaign. But it does seem, if we look at that region now and we look at IS or ISIS, Al-Qaeda to a lesser degree now, Boko Haram, that's trying to likely flex more muscle or impact by pledging its relationship to ISIS, since no one really knows how much the connection is. But it does seem as though these organizations are practically acting, you know, like world powers. And I wondered your thoughts on this, but also as we're wrapping up, on this show we've talked about the Cold War between the GOP in Congress and the White House in relation to a few areas in the region, in relation to Iran and the negotiations, in relation to Israel's interest, for example. So just some final thoughts from you on all of this, helping us to wade our way through this quagmire.
Well, I think what we're seeing the Republicans doing around Iran is not that different than what Republicans did in terms of opposing arms control efforts by the Ford and Carter administrations with the Soviet Union, their opposition to a comprehensive test ban treaty, their opposition to a nuclear freeze. These right-wing Republicans, you know, have never liked arms control agreements of any kind. So I think the role of AIPAC in this particular case is somewhat exaggerated. But I think I've had serious issues with President Obama on a number of policies in the region. At least I think he acknowledges there are limits to American power, and that there are even there governments we don't like Iran. We can't. It's not like the 1950s when we can just send in the CIA and overthrow a government whenever we want it. The power is a lot it's a lot more pluralistic than it used to be, and we have to deal with those realities, including new complex phenomenon that there aren't really good answers to, such as the Islamic State, and that again, but I think again it comes down to the point that it was U.S. militarism and intervention that is at the root of many of these problems, and somehow I really don't think that increasing such intervention and militarism is going to make things better.
Yeah, and Reese Ehrlich, your final thoughts.
Well, the U.S. policy is actually helping the Islamic State to grow and recruit. That's the irony, that supposedly the bombing is dealing them devastating military blows. There's battles that are being won and lost, but politically it's been a disaster. The Islamic State went from a horrific human rights violating local organization into an international phenomenon as a direct result of the U.S. bombing and the publicity that it got. It's been able to recruit more people from the Middle East and to a lesser extent from Europe. It's you mentioned the Boko Haram affiliation. Three different militias in Libya have pledged their allegiance to the Islamic State. Now, that doesn't mean that these are all centrally controlled conspiracy threatening the United States.
Yeah.
It means that they're still continuing mainly in their local struggle in their local attacks, but the fact that they've now seen Islamic State as kind of replaced al-Qaeda as the go-to jihadi group that some of these extremists now favor. And all of this can be attributed directly back to the U.S. bombing policy.
Okay. Dr. Horn, final thought.
Just keep a close eye on the Nigerian elections in a few days. There's evidence to suggest that some of President Goodluck Jonathan's opponents are looking the other way with regard to the rise of the Boko Haram in order to weaken and destabilize his regime. And if he loses, you might be surprised to find that Boko Haram continues to lose steam. This is also suggested by the fact that the Chadian military has done a better job than the Nigerian military in focusing on Boko Haram. Likewise, for white South African mercenaries who have been hired by the Goodluck Jonathan government to fight Boko Haram.
Right. Well, on that note, we're going to have to leave it there. But Stephen Zunis, Reese Ehrlich, Gerald Horn, it's just been fascinating. Thank you so much for helping us out today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Adam Carey, Sherelle Withers, our engineers, Federico Garcia, Kiana Turner, and of course, assistant producer, Kevin Walker. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to follow us on Twitter, SoTrue, KPFK, and like and friend us on Facebook, please. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.